now we have Greg P. Great.
Hi, my name is Greg P. and I'm an alcoholic. In case you weren't tracking, that means I am powerless over alcohol. My life has become unmanageable. Trying to start off kind of with the, I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything that I have today that is good can be traced back to being sober and my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm thankful for all sorts of things. I'm not by default a kind of a thankful person, but I'm thankful for a lot of things today. And I didn't wake up this morning and try to brush my teeth and puke. That's a good thing to be thankful for. The list goes on and on. So I come from a long line of alcoholics. There's alcoholics on both sides of my mother's family and my father's family. They were both from Texas, from Houston. Got married in Houston. My dad was a petroleum engineer, worked for Chevron his whole life. They moved to California, got pregnant, and I was born in Taft. It was a wonderful place, lots of oil in Taft. So that was 63, I was born in 63. We moved a lot. So I was kind of the chubby little geeky fat kid in class, so I didn't have, wasn't a jock or cool or on the football team or any of that stuff. And on top of that, we moved all the time. So both my parents drank. I think they were kind of doing the geographic thing, like things would get weird or it's time to go or whatever, and they'd go somewhere else. But we moved all the time. So I sat down and counted up once, and I think we moved 21 times by the time I graduated high school. All over the place. So basically, if there's oil there, we probably live there. All over California, all over Louisiana, overseas. I lived in Saudi Arabia for 3 years. That's the longest I lived anywhere, any place by the time I graduated high school, Saudi Arabia, 3 years. So it's just constantly moving. So if you're the fat, not cool, chubby kid that doesn't do sports and you move every school year, basically, that's just not a recipe for success. At least it wasn't for me. My parents, neither one of them were really interested, didn't seem to be interested, and didn't talk about any sort of spirituality or religion or anything like that. So that we were a very secular household, didn't go to church, didn't have any of that stuff. So I guess the good news is I don't have a resentment against some organized church that, I hated when I was a kid, but we didn't go to church at all. And I think that contributed to me feeling different and outsiders, that I really had no spiritual guidance whatsoever. And so I think that's part of the way I always felt different. I always felt like the outsider. I would have friends, but I was always real hesitant with getting friends because I knew I was just going to leave again. I don't know how many times, I came home, parents wouldn't say anything. I'd go to school. They knew for, a while that we were going to move. I'd go to school, I'd come home, and everything would be in boxes. And it's like, oh, you're going to leave again? Dad got a promotion, we got to go, It's like that over and over and over and over again. So after a while, I just kind of gave up on making friends. Since I was kind of the weird loner kid, tended to hang out with, in middle school or whatever, hang out with, the druggies or the stoners or whatever. They're basically, the group that will accept anyone, basically. So I'd hang out with them, even though I wasn't using, didn't want to use at that time, or drink. And then I was in eighth grade on a Friday night. I was home alone. I always stay up late and watch, science fiction movies or whatever. So there's normal behavior for me to stay up late after everybody else went to bed. And I snuck downstairs, and my folks had a big liquor cabinet, all sorts of bottles, and I just took a big glass, poured a little bit off each bottle in that glass, and took it back upstairs and chugged it. And, I'd never really drank before. I guess I had a sip of beer or something, but that was really the first time I drank. So I drank 8 ounces of hard liquor as fast as I could. Immediately got really drunk, got sick, went in the bathroom, puked, and said, "This is awesome. I got to do this again." You know, I was like, like right off the bat, you know, there's like something wrong with that. Then I passed out. And then that kind of became my regular thing. So I was in eighth grade. How old that is? 12, 13, somewhere in there. Not very old, before high school. Started doing that. And then because I was kind of hanging out with the weirdos and the stoners anyway, kind of like, you know, so they started, you know, offering me things. I started taking it and pursuing it more. I didn't really have a job or any money, so I couldn't really buy anything. But I never had a problem really with alcohol. I just had to be cool about it and you know, take it out of multiple bottles and, you know, try not to get caught. So they were drinking enough. Both my parents were drinking enough at the time you know, they go like, "Where did Jack Daniels go?" Like, "You must have drank it," and whatever. So I never really got busted for stealing their stuff. I steal cigarettes from my mom. She got me in trouble for that, but I didn't get trouble for. So anyway, I was drinking and using. By the time I was in high school, I was basically drinking or using every day. My folks got divorced in there somewhere, and then me and my sister, this is just the two of us, we're basically ping pong between them. So we go live with my mom for 6 months and she'd get tired or whatever, and we go live with my dad and I go live with my mom and go live with my dad, and we just ping pong back and forth. So my stepmom, I kind of like living with my dad and my stepmom because she had like chronic pain issues and lots of cool pills. So you go look for the label that says "do not take with alcohol." I was like, that's the good one. So I was just, you know, just really kind of a crapshoot in high school. I was kind of a smart, geeky kid, and I should have been able to, you know, go on to college and do great and wondrous things, and it just didn't work out that way because of my drinking and using. I was accepted in computer science at Cal Poly in 81 and lasted one quarter, basically because I didn't show up to class because I was too busy doing other stuff. Flunked out, and that started my 10-year stretch of basically no real job. I'd go work at part-time at fast food place or just that kind of work. I worked at every major fast food place, restaurants like busboy or dishwasher, that kind of work. Just enough work to buy alcohol and have a roof over my head and gas in the car, and that was it. And you know, I had really poor work habits. I was, you know, late all the time, wouldn't call in sick, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so I got fired a lot. And basically because I was a flake and I was drinking all the time. Kind of like being a busboy or closing shifts at places, because there's always like, you know, people buy a pitcher of beer and take a couple glasses out and leave the pitcher. It's like, you know, what's up with that? That's alcohol abuse. So I drink. So when I work at those jobs, I'd just be hammered at, you know, trying to clean up. So let's see. I joined the Army, California Army National Guard in 1985. That was a few years out of high school. I took their little test. They have a test to see, like, you know, what kind of job you could get or whatever, and basically aced it. They said, "You can have any job you want, any OS you want." It's like, cool. "What's the longest school you have?" And they're like, "Language school, DLI? You can go learn Farsi or something." And, "Nah, I don't want to learn a language. What else you got?" And I always come in interested in electronics and stuff like that, computer stuff. I said, "Well, the next longest school we have is this electronic school." I'm like, "Okay, I'll take that one." So I went off, you know, to basic, and then a 6-month AIT was basically learning how to fix electronic stuff, oscilloscopes and voltmeters and stuff like that. Came back, went to my first drill. It was the unit in Atascadero, basically a maintenance unit in Atascadero, still there. And my job, they had outsourced, like, right in there somewhere. And so, like, I came back and had no job, basically. The thing I went to school for, the Army no longer did. They hired contractors for that. That's great. So they were like, "You went to radios, or electronics school, right?" And he's like, "Yeah." I was, "How about you do radios?" It's like, "Oh, okay, I'll do radios." So I became the radio repairer at the maintenance unit. that was a drill thing, so that wasn't really a job, right? I'd show up once a month, and I'd get a couple $100 or whatever. But I was talking, there's, I don't know, like 300 or 400 guys there go to those drill weekends. And some of those guys did their guard job, but they did it full time as civilians up at Camp Roberts. I think my platoon sergeant was one of them. So after, you know, he got to know me, I've been there a couple of years or whatever, he's like, you know, have you ever wanted to have a full-time job, like a real job? I was like, yeah. And so he said, why don't you come up to Camp Roberts, and I know some guys, and you go and see so-and-so or whatever, and I'll get you a job. So I did, and that was a wonderful thing. You know, that was the first real job I ever had, with had insurance, you know, 40 hours a week. All the guys were the guys from my unit that I knew. We tended to all be partiers, at least all drinkers. A lot of them were partiers too. And it was just kind of expected that was okay behavior. So, you know, that doesn't work these days in a job, but back in the day, that was kind of, at least Army guys did. They literally had a soda machine out back that had soda in it, and then some of the unmarked buttons were beer. It was kind of awesome. So I went to work there, and I was there for a couple of years, and then they got real serious about drug testing. And so I was doing a little bit of this and that, pretty much anything, everything. No needles, but I'd try anything else. And they got really serious about that, and it came quickly. And so I really didn't want to lose my job because of drug use, and so I just stopped all that and just kept drinking. So I became drinking only at that point. So I don't know if that was a good or a bad thing. I guess no meth is a good thing. Let's see. So that was kind of my career. I was basically a turret mechanic, tank turret mechanic. There's lots of computers and electronics and hydraulics and stuff in a tank turret, so that's pretty cool. At some point after doing that for a few years though, and I was kind of like the de facto computer guy, like if there was some computer thing going on, like the ordering system, they transitioned from paper to computer, I was kind of in charge of that. And then I got to a point in my career where they said, like, you could continue to be a tank turret mechanic, or you could think about something else. And I was like, well, there's not a whole lot of civilian employment as a tank turret mechanic, so maybe I should learn computers. So that's kind of like my career kind of changed midstream there, and I started doing that. So I still go, you know, hanging out with Army guys, doing Army stuff. All the Army guys are drinking and smoking, you know, cigarettes anyway, and they just tolerated that behavior. So, you know, I found a place I could work that tolerated my behavior versus behaving the way you ought to be to work at a real job. And that's kind of the story of my life. That's kind of how I picked my friends too back in the day. It was like, he drinks more than me, so I look good when I stand next to him. Because he's a total shit show. I'm just a little bit of a shit show. You try to use that on like significant others, right? He's like, oh, I'm not half as bad as Eric is. You should see him when he gets going. So I don't know. I hadn't really been able to do any of the school stuff I thought I was going to do when I was a kid. I had a job. It was a decent job. I had a job, but it wasn't like the job I wanted. Didn't seem to have a whole lot of future potential. I had problems with relationships. You know, just everything just wasn't going very well. So towards the end, I was doing more computer work at that point. So I got sober, and I've been sober multiple times, but most of the times that I've been sober were because somebody was mad at me, you know, whoever that was. And I'd be sober just long enough to get them off my back, and then I'd go right back like dieting or something. And then I would go back to drinking. So I got sober in 2007, the first time, serious time. And I stayed sober, I got sober around New Year's in 2007. And I was sober until my birthday, which is in June. So 6 months I was sober. And then somebody slid me, one of my Army buddies slid me a beer. Said, no, it won't hurt, it's just a beer. And I drank that beer. That was it. One beer. The next day I had three beers. The next day I had a 12-pack and a bottle of vodka, and I was off to the races again. And then I stayed drunk for 6 months, and then I got sober this time, which stuck for me. That was January 30th, 2008. I got sober this time. At the end, the way it was just a daily thing. It was just kind of the same thing over and over again. Last thing I would do, if I didn't flat pass out, if I was still walking around at bedtime, I would open a beer, glug about, you know, that much off of it, fill it up the rest of the way of vodka, and sit on the nightstand. And that way I had something to drink when I woke up. And so it was like that. And I'd get up in the morning, I'd be sick, I'd, you know, try to get ready for work or whatever. Usually puke. I swear I'm never going to do that again. I had a little, I worked in San Luis, and I lived in Paso, and I rode the bus from Paso to San Luis. Saved money. I still had a license, but I was saving money. I would get my backpack ready, which included like topping off the pint vodka I had in my backpack, and then I would go to work. I'd try not to drink at lunchtime. That pint was supposed to be for the trip home. Then I'd, you know, do my thing, get back on the bus. On the way to the bus stop, I'd slam that pint. I'd be all tuned up by the time I was on the bus, and I'd come home and I'd hit the store on the way home, and I'd do it again. So I just, that's my thing. Physically, I had, you know, like a distended liver. The doctor's like, you're going to get fatty liver or whatever. You know, I never tell the doctor the truth, so they didn't really know what was going on. And then probably 6 months before I got sober, something like that, I got an esophageal hemorrhage. So drinkers get those. It's like when the blood vessels in your throat get thin because you've been drinking so much whatever, and one of them pops, and you start bleeding like a lot, fast. And you can't like put pressure on your throat because got to breathe, right? So there's nothing you can do really other than get them to the emergency room as fast as possible and hope they don't bleed to death before they get there. So that happened to me. It was like 11 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. I had drank one beer so far, and I drink like half the beer, you know, because I usually get up and drink a couple of beers in the morning, and it just felt weird somehow. And then that, when once the blood comes into your stomach, you immediately puke. You can't help it. And so you just, everywhere. So it looked like a horror movie. There was just blood splattered all over the walls and a big pool of blood. And I yelled for my wife, and she came down and freaked out, like, what's going on? And took me to the ER. You know, got to the ER, made it to the ER. The doctor's like, you know, well, how much have you had to drink today? And you say what you always say, oh, just a couple beers. You know, that's the standard story, right? Anyway, I was in the hospital for 3 or 4 days. I got the stern lecture from the doctor, you know, you can't drink like this anymore. It's going to happen again. You know, I don't want to see you in here again, blah, blah, blah. I was like, yes, sir, three bags full. So I did not drink. I went home and I was a little, you know, I was scared, but scared never stopped me. So I didn't drink for about 2 weeks, and I was a daily drinker, of course. Didn't drink for about 2 weeks, and it was like, and drink a beer, and it's like, oh, that didn't hurt. Drink a couple more, that didn't hurt. It didn't happen again. And within a couple of weeks, I was back at it. And so, I don't know, maybe a month later, not too long later, it happened again. And it was like a complete repeat. Like, you put the tape in the VCR and hit rewind or whatever. It's like, puke blood everywhere, wife freaked out, calls 911, the ambulance comes and gets you. I show up at the same doctor at the emergency room. It's like, I told you that you can, blah, blah, blah. It's like, So, I mean, that's how it was going. At that point, though, I had tried to stop all sorts of ways on my own. I had done, you know, meditation and acupuncture and alternative healing, whatever stuff. And like, I remember I went to the acupuncturist in Templeton, an old Chinese lady in Templeton, like a legit acupuncturist. And she, you know, didn't, you basically lay flat on the table and she puts some needles in and does an examination, whatever. And she said, you very scared. And it's like, How'd you know that? So what she prescribed me was Chinese herbs for fear. That's what she prescribed me. I didn't recognize at the time that fear had anything to do with me. I've since learned differently. Anyway, at the end, I didn't know a way of living other than the way I was living. I was managing to kind of hang on. I mean, I still sort of had a house and sort of had a wife and sort of had a job. But I was in like deep doo-doo in all those arenas. And then I couldn't drink like I needed to drink to stay, you know, to maintain basically, because this bleeding in the throat thing kept happening. And I was just screwed. I didn't know what to do. So I guess I got to that point where I was desperate. And, you know, they got that little crappy newspaper around, like in San Luis, it's New Times. It's like a free weekly thing that comes out. And there was an ad in there that always caught my eye in the back. It was about that big, like a quarter of the page, and it was just a black and white drawing of a couple bottles over on their side, and it says, another empty drink, do something about it, and they had a phone number. So I tore that ad out, and I hung it on my monitor at work. I didn't call it, but I hung it on the monitor at work and looked at it and kept thinking, well, I should call it. So in January, 2008 in January, I thought, what the heck, I'll call the number. I don't want to freaking go to the emergency room again. And I called it, and it was a doctor in San Luis. So it was you think it would be the central office or something, but it wasn't. It was a doctor in San Luis, an addiction doctor in San Luis. And he said, why don't you come see me? It was a Wednesday. Why don't you come see me, and we'll find out what's going on with you. I was like, okay. So I went to see him in San Luis, and it was like a regular doctor's office, you know, just same old thing. You fill out a bunch of paperwork, and they weigh you and do your blood pressure, and just a regular doctor's office visit. Then I went into the doctor's office, and he's like, well, tell me, why are you here? And, you know, I don't know about you, but I always give him, like, some sad song and dance story about how depressed I am so I can get the cool pills or whatever. Started into that same spiel, and he, like, let me go on and on for about 5 or 10 minutes, and he's like, just stop. It's like, I hate to break it to you, but you're just a garden variety alcoholic. You need to stop drinking and go to a meeting. And I was like, oh, wow, I hear that. So I was like, okay, yeah, whatever, sure. You know, I just wanted to get out of there. I had scoped out where the liquor store was that was near his office so that when I left his office, I could hit the liquor store on the way home. So I had a plan, you know, so it's like, no, you need to go to a meeting. It's like, well, okay, yeah, I'll go to a meeting someday, yay. And he's like, no, here's the list of the meetings. Pick one today, you're going to a meeting. And I was like, ah. So I did. So he had me come back, it was a Wednesday, had me come back on a Friday, basically said, so, you know, it was basically acting like a sponsor. So, did you go to a meeting? He's like, yeah, I went to a meeting. Well, which meeting did you go to? And he's like, oh, I went to, you know, whatever, Thursday night in Paso or whatever. And he's like, oh, you did, huh? It's like, well, did you see so-and-so there? It's like, what, you've got spies in all these meetings? It's like, so he did have spies in all the meetings. So I tried to, early on, say I went when I didn't, and he knew that I didn't already because he had spies in those meetings. And that's how it went down. So he was, in effect, my first sponsor. I started going to meetings at that point. I did all the stuff they told me to do, and I was ready. The army thing is to say, like, if they tell me to stand on one leg and cluck like a chicken, that's what I'm going to do. That's how I felt, was that I didn't care how stupid or retarded or whatever it was that they told me to do, I was going to do it because I didn't want to drink like this anymore. So they said 90 meetings in 90 days. Paso ABC Group had at least 3 meetings a day, like morning, noon, and night. And the morning one was early enough that you could like go to it and still go to work. So I did that for a long time. They kept, blah, 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 get a sponsor, blah. They'd say that all the time, and I didn't feel much like getting a sponsor, but I did. The first guy I asked said, no, I'm too busy, I got too many people. So I was like, oh, that was a big deflation, but I worked up the courage. You know, I had like a list of these are the guys in meetings. Like, if you're looking for a sponsor, you just go to meetings and like watch the people in the meetings. Like, oh, that guy's cool. That's how I picked a sponsor. Like, I want what he's got. So the second guy I asked became my sponsor and basically worked me through the steps. They did the steps. It was like a secret formula, the way they did the steps. So he had papers that he had gotten from his sponsor, who had gotten from his sponsor, and they were mysterious and not labeled. And so it would say step one. It was a typewritten, you know, like a copy from a book, but all the stuff that identified it was redacted. So it had, you know, step one, and then talked about step one and had some questions. But they had whited out the page numbers and the name of the book. And then, interestingly, throughout the text on the pages, they had whited something out and then wrote alcohol above it, or alcoholic or alcohol above it. It was just weird. It's like, you know, some secret club or something with these. And so I did, you know, he basically had a packet of like 8 pages for step one, and he handed me that and said, this is what I did, this is what you do too. And there was a bunch of reading and a bunch of writing. And then I basically made, you know, my step one was like, I don't know, whatever, 6 or 8 pages long of handwritten stuff. That took me a week or two. Then I turned my homework in and gave it back to him. We sat down and talked about it. And then he gave me step number two, which is the same deal. Another set of mysterious pages like that. So at some point in there, you know, about step three, I think, I was like, I'm going to find this damn book. And so I started like looking for weird phrases in the thing that he was giving me and Googling them. And it was the Narcotics Anonymous Step Working Guide is what it was. And these are a bunch of old-timey AA guys, and they didn't want to say narcotics out loud, so they had redacted all the drugs and alcohol stuff out of it and just wrote in alcohol above it because they didn't want it to say addict or whatever. Anyway, that's how I did the steps. So I used a bunch of old cranky AA guys were using a redacted form of the step working guide for an NA to do the steps. That's how I did the steps. So there's a lot of writing. That's a good thing. I wish AA had a version of that. Anyway, so I did the steps. Took me a while, so I started working the steps probably when I was about 6 months-ish, maybe. Got my sponsor when I was 4 months, started actually writing when I was like 6 months, and I don't think I was done with the steps until like 15 months. I kind of got stuck on step four. I don't know why so much. Everybody's like, oh, you're talking in meetings with your buddies or whatever. It's like, oh, step four is a bitch. You don't, you know, I don't want to do it, blah, blah, blah. It's like, and so I was like basically scared by step four, I think. Not that I had been a horrible felon or robbed banks or anything, but, you know, I just didn't want to do it. And then after I did it, it wasn't so bad. So I don't know why I got stuck on that. But anyway, that's what I did as far as, and then I, you know, just kept it up. I was going to meetings at least, you know, like every other day going to meetings, talking to my sponsor, helping other people. Somewhere in there too, in my first year, I like going to book studies because they make you talk less in book studies. And when you are talking, you're just reading out of the book and you're not actually having to like say anything personal. And I like that. So I tend to go to a lot of book studies, but not because I was super interested in the book, but just because I like the format. And so they made me into, I got voluntold to be the secretary for the book study, Thursday night book study in Paso. And I've had a commitment, at least one commitment ever since, continuously ever since. So, you know, whatever that is, 15 years of having commitments. And so that was an important part of what happened and how I got sober and stayed sober was having commitments. I just kept doing it. If I had any recommendations for you is like whatever you were doing when you first got sober that worked for you and you stayed sober, keep doing it. However many meetings a week, whoever it was you were talking to, whatever places you were going, just if it's working, why fix it, right? Just keep going. So that's kind of what happened to me. What's it like now? I'm doing on time. All right. I was going to start a timer and didn't. What's it like now? I think that the reason that I felt so different when I was a kid was a lack of spirituality. I think that I'm kind of a spiritual guy, and I seek you know, a higher power or whatever. It's kind of the thing that I need to have a connection with is the higher power. And I didn't really have an avenue for that when I was a kid. Parents weren't interested in that. I thought it was the sign of like a weak person, like a mentally weak person or whatever, to have a higher power in a spiritual relationship or whatever. I'd been to church off and on when, you know, as a young man, you know, I have a girlfriend at the church or whatever, and you go to a few meetings there or whatever. I went to church in the Army because on Sundays, if you go to church, you don't have to clean the barracks. That's why I went to church. But, you know, now AA's taught me a spiritual way of life. So I don't go to a regular church, but I get, you know, my spirituality fed here, and I'm, you know, in general, a happier person for having a spiritual life here. And I think that's really the whole came, you know, when I was trying to think before this meeting, you know, what was it like when I was a little kid? Is I had that hole in my heart, and then when I got to like middle school, high school, I was just pouring alcohol in it, trying to fill that hole up, and that was basically the pattern my whole life. And so AA has made me, you know, relatively happy, joyous, and free, certainly a lot more of those things than I'd ever been before. And spirituality, the S word, is kind of the thing that AA has taught me the most about. I never really valued people before. I wrote value humans on my list of things to talk about. You know, I was more interested in how things worked and fixing things and making things better and stuff, and not talking to people and helping people and learning about people and listening to people. And I do all that now as a result of AA and this program. I have better relations with my family. It's not perfect. Things still go sideways, and usually me shooting my mouth off makes somebody mad, but it's a lot better than it used to be. I stay in service, so like right now I have 3 commitments. So I'm a secretary of the park meeting on Wednesdays, noon. The GSR for the park meeting, which means I go to the monthly district meetings, Zoom meetings, and try to do GSR stuff, bring what the group wants to the district and bring what the district says back to the group. And then I'm the secretary for the 52nd District Intergroup Central Office, which means I go to those meetings and then I take all the notes. People like how I take notes. So that's just an example. And then as far as like sponsoring people, I have done that off and on. I was not like a serial sponsor, or, you know, I always have 8 guys in the wing somewhere. I don't do that. So, but I'm open to being a sponsor for people. I've had a number of people that I was doing sponsor-like things with, but I wasn't officially their sponsor. Because it's usually easy to talk to someone and say, hey, you don't have to pick me as your sponsor, but you need to have somebody help you for a minute until you pick out the guy you want. I've done that a few times. And then I had, you know, one actually legit sponsee who went in and out, and had a lot of mental issues, like schizophrenia issues, but managed to get their stuff together, and this last time stayed sober, has been sober like 18 months now. I've known that person for like 5 years. So that's pretty good. And I don't judge myself by how many sponsees I have or whether they're still sober, because I'm sober still, so I'm good to go. I guess that's basically it. I did not want to be an AA. I was living with my mother at the end of my high school, senior year in high school. My dad had kicked me out for stealing my stepmother's pills and being a dick. And so my mother took me in, and then I'd been there a couple of months, and she liked gin. So I was, you know, I could help myself to the gin and the cigarettes. And then she got sober and started going to meetings and doing all this, and that was a real bummer. And then she knew how I was drinking and using, and started dragging me to meetings. And it's like, you know, so I had been to the meetings, you know, basically my mother on a mom card. My mother made me go to the meetings, and And I did not want to go to meetings. So, you know, I was kind of dragged kicking and screaming in here, but it's been a good thing, and I've been doing it for a while now. And so just keep coming back and learn more about how to stay sober, how to be happy being sober. I've done some cool stuff as a sober person. Stuff you sit around when you're drunk. I don't know about you, but I sit around when I'm drunk and talk to my friends. Oh, we're gonna go do this. We're gonna do that. We'll go to the lake and we'll go to blah blah blah. And you never go. You just sit around and talk about it. And now that I'm sober, I actually go places and do things, and it's freaking cool. So I'm happy to be sober, and glad you all showed up to listen to me rant and rave. So thank you.